There's a new financial facility for transitioning farmers.
That transition is not going to happen for free. So farmers are going to need to spend stroke invest in transitioning. The facility that we're providing is designed to both reward and incentivize farmers in that transition.
We've a tech update from the LEAF conference and details of a new bursary to encourage new entrants.
It's an award that we're hoping is going to last for several years. It's got some funding and essentially it's for someone who is living in Lincolnshire between the ages of 16 and 28, is a new entrant into agriculture and needs a bit of a leg up.
Sean's here with a look at the crops and some important agronomy advice, and we'll see how the markets are doing and what the weather's going to do this week.
The Week in Agriculture. This is the Farming Programme with Steve Orchard.
This is the Farming Programme podcast for Sunday the 16th of February 2025. Good morning. Hope it's been a good week for you. It's been another busy one with the Lincolnshire Farming Conference. Some thoughts from that on next week's programme. And another big farmer protest in Westminster. Lincolnshire farmer Taran Lee was among the many thousands there.
So I'm in London, down with Farmers to Action, protesting against inheritance tax. Tractors are starting to come in now. There's musical horns. I don't know if you can hear that in the background. But they're all starting to queue up just down Whitehall. This isn't just a protest for farmers. It's a protest for small businesses to join us, for the public to join us and take this fight, you know, to the government. There's a lot of support out there at the moment. We're getting a lot of thumbs up and a lot of waving. I don't know whether you could hear the musical horns in the background a little bit earlier. But we've got people dancing along at the side of the streets to them. So, yeah, there is some really good support here.
The fight continues. Now, the focus of last week's Lincolnshire Farming Conference was inspiring the next generation with advice and guidance to encourage new entrants. As I said, more from the conference next week, but a new bursary has been announced by Lincolnshire Young Farmers in memory of Alec Truelove, who, as you will remember, sadly took his own life last year. I had a chat at the conference with YFC's Kate Knight to get the details.
So Alec was he was an amazing young farmer. He was really forward thinking. I can see why he was so successful in his career as well. And he was the chairman of Louth at the time, unfortunately, that he took his life, and had been a real integral part and of Lincolnshire Young Farmers, and we adored him.
He's clearly inspired a lot of people, and that's led to a new award that you're launching at Lincolnshire Young Farmers. So do you want to tell me all about that?
Yeah, so Alec was a new entrant into agriculture in that he didn't come from an agricultural family or background. And his father, David, and I and the Ag Society and the NFU Mutual Alford office have worked together, along with Alan Robson, on a new award called the New Love New Entrant Award. It's an award that we're hoping is going to last for several years. It's got some funding, and essentially it's for someone who is living in Lincolnshire between the ages of 16 and 28, is a new entrant into agriculture and needs a bit of a leg up. It's a £1,000 bursary to someone who can present their ideas and their plan. It's a little bit of a Dragon's Den style interview process, and then the award would be announced and presented at the Lincolnshire Show.
Okay, now who's paying for this?
Well, a mixture of a few fabulous organisations, and David Newlove wanted to have money in there, and people have pledged that to make the award last for several years. So we're hoping, you know, this is its first year, but we're hoping that we can keep awarding that bursary for several years to come.
Okay, now Alec was a new entrant, as you say, into farming, and we've been talking this morning about how difficult that can be. This bursary, if somebody's successful, what can it be used for?
I mean, I'm thinking that someone who's either starting up their own business and needs to purchase some type of equipment. It might be someone who's starting out in their career, you know, post-education and wants to do more training. So I think it's, you know, anything really that somebody can put forward in a bit of a plan that's going to help them get into agriculture, whether they're setting up a business or, you know, working for somebody else and need some money for training. You know, we're just excited to see what people might bring forward.
So what's the application process? How does somebody, A, find out all about the detail of this,
and apply if they wish to.
So applications are open now and close at the end of Feb, and then the shortlist and the actual interview process happens 23rd of March. So if somebody wants to apply, they need to email me in the first instance, and then I send an application pack and a bit more detail about the award. And you can find that on all the Lincolnshire Young Farmers socials and also the Lincolnshire Agricultural Society socials. Have to say, you don't have to be a Young Farmer member for this award. This is an award, you know, open to anybody that lives in Lincolnshire between that age bracket.
Okay, and what's your email address finally?
kate.knight@linksyfc.org.uk.
All right, Kate, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And just to mention that for those who apply and are not successful, there will be mentoring offered to help you get started on the road to farming. Let's talk crops and agronomy now, though, with independent agronomist Sean Sparling walking through the still very damp fields for us. Morning, Sean.
Yes, morning, Steve. Not drying much, is it? You know, another half an inch of rain for me since we spoke last week. It just doesn't know how to be dry, does it, in February? And with the return of 5 degree days and 2 degree nights, along with these murky, misty days, it's not drying in between the showers anyway. So very little in the way of land work happening at the moment, apart from up on some of the heath fields where the odd bit of ploughing and drilling is underway. But as I say, it's sticky, the soils have fallen back to below 3 degrees in the main now, so not a lot happening growth wise anywhere anyway. We covered the wheat options incidentally pretty well last week, I think, so I'm not going to go over that again, other than to say, because it's unlikely you'll be drilling much before the middle of this coming week if you can, the only winter wheat varieties that are still relatively safe to drill from now to the end of the month, apart from the true spring wheats of course, are going to be Skyfall, Bruin, Bairstow, Swallow and Bileppi, I suppose, if you're that way inclined. They'll all comfortably drilled to the end of February. Bileppi and Skyfall may be just a little bit beyond. So if conditions do happen to improve and you've still got wheat to get in, there is still hope. Plenty of slug activity in these wet soils as well. In some of that which was drilled a couple of weeks ago, we can find some damage from hollowing, as well as some of that which went in late autumn. So après-moi la déluge, as Del Boy would say. Do keep a close eye on slugs. In these crops, as things progress, you know, it is perfect conditions for slugs. So get bran traps under an old tile or a bag. Very useful way of monitoring them. Helps as an indicator of their activity or not. And crops likely to be moving far more slowly than the slugs means that damage can be severe if you leave it unchecked. And if you do go out drilling, or if you got some in earlier this month but you didn't put your pre-ems on, these later drilled crops are, of course, unlikely to have such a high weed burden than autumn drilled ones, and any pre-planned pre-emergence recommendations that have been delayed should just be double checked after any of these delays to make sure they're still crop safe. Any fields drilled last autumn which you didn't get sprayed then, also look at them with a cocked eyebrow so that you can plan a suitable strategy over these coming weeks. Residuals for blackgrass, wild oats, meadowgrasses, etc. still a very good option even in emerge crops as long as the weeds are small. Mixes containing synmethylene or ethyfumosate probably your best bet, but do be careful on waterlogged soils when using any residual, and watch your total dose of ethyfumosate if that's your weapon of choice, particularly if you've got sugar beet in your rotation, because you can't put more than a kilo of ethyfumosate on any field in a 3-year period. You can go from 2 leaves to 6 leaves of the wheat with something like Zerton. You can go up to growth stage 30 with synmethylene. A bit of flufenacet and DFF might still help as well. You can put that on up to 3 tillers. So speak to your advisor about all of those things, but don't expect miracles in levels of control, because you're going to be disappointed if you do. It's not going to be perfect, but it should be well worth the effort. Plenty of yellowing as well starting to show out there too. Mostly nitrogen, I think, because manganese tends not to show until the growth begins, and there's a lot of lush crops shutting down leaves which are turning yellow. But it is important to correct any nutrient deficiency issues before you go chucking herbicide on for grass weed control. Anyway, as I say, given the soil temperatures and the lack of active growth, maybe just hold your fire until things warm up a bit and you'll get something back from them. Manganese sulfate powder's a little bit kinder to the crop than liquids in some cases, but a good quality inorganic liquid should be absolutely fine as long as there are no frosts about, and it might be irrelevant, but do stay 7 days away from the rolls if you've been out rolling. No rush for nitrogen out here on these sleeping wheats, as wet and cold as it is, little and often, I suppose, when you do go on the more likely lads towards the end of the month. You don't want another couple of inches of rain falling onto 80 odd kilos of applied ammonia nitrate now on cold soils and slow growth. Shallow rooted crops as well, don't forget. So if you get rain on top of nitrogen now and there's no growth, your losses are going to be massive. And remember, you can apply untreated urea, that's urea without a urease inhibitor, up until the end of March. After that, it has to be protected or applied with an inhibitor, or you should switch over to another nitrogen form such as ammonium nitrate. But urea doesn't leach and it works best in the cold and the damp conditions anyway. So urea, probably the safest choice from a minimal losses perspective if you are going to go in cold, wet conditions like they are now. Propizamide, showing some good effects on grass weeds now in the oilseed rape. It can take up to 10 weeks before you see real visible effect most years, but very easy to see the effects after 3 or 4 weeks this year. First signs being when the shoot base of the grass weed starts to look like a spring onion and they just break off with a gentle tug. Charlock generally well controlled by the frosts over the last few weeks. Some very big plants dying on the feet. We always get smaller plants surviving the frost, particularly if they're sheltered below the canopy. So Bifenox is really the only option for Charlock now. It's an emu, it's off-label, specifically for Cranesbill actually, but it does give moderately reliable incidental Charlock control. Just be careful though, because the only thing that's really protecting your rape crop is a good layer of wax. And with the state of some of these crops, not least because of the pigeon damage, I would think very carefully before chucking Bifenox at them. You've got until the buds are enclosed, so you've still got plenty of time if need be. And the oilseed rape, of course, getting ready for its first hit of nitrogen and sulfur in that first dose when you do go. And it's going to want that, I think, as soon as conditions allow you to go, really. Spring barley's drilled last March did really well, so there's plenty of time to get barley's in without having to maul it in. People as well talking about drilling beans now. Remember, beans don't need to vernalise, so to some extent, winter and spring bean seed can be used interchangeably. But you need much higher seed rates of winter beans when they're drilled in the spring, and they'll always be 20-odd percent lower yielding than true spring beans that are drilled in the spring, as well as being a much later to harvest. So pre-em herbicide-wise, we have no straight pendimethalin products approved for spring beans anymore either, only available in mixtures with imazamox or clomazone. So plan the pre-ems now. Imazamox very good on brassica weeds, clomazone very good for cleavers, but you pay your money, you take your choice. So it's all a little bit samey, it's wet, it's cold, we're all miserable. Can't help feeling that this is the calm before the storm though. So let's see what the next 7 days bring.
Thanks as ever, Sean. Coming up, the markets and the weather, and the LEAF conference took place in London a few days ago. We'll get a tech updates and hear all about a new finance facility for farmers transitioning or starting down that road next.
The Week in Agriculture. This is the Farming Programme with Steve Orchard.
This is the Farming Programme podcast for Sunday, the 16th of February, 2025. I'm Steve Orchard, and I went to a very interesting conference by LEAF, linking environment and farming, the people behind Open Farm Sunday and much more. It was in London a few days ago. We'll get a tech update from the University of Lincoln's Professor Simon Pearson in a moment. First, a new financial facility aimed at helping farmers transition profitably whilst reducing carbon emissions and improving soil health is now available. At the conference, I spoke with MD and founder of the Agricultural Bank Oxbury, Nick Evans. Nick, tell us about the facility and why it's needed, but first, give us a bit of background to Oxbury.
Okay, so Oxbury is a fully regulated bank. One of really only a handful, relatively, of new banks in the last 250 years. The principal difference is we don't lend to normal people, we only lend to farmers. So, and I deliberately say that actually because farmers aren't normal. They're better than normal. They are a superb bunch. I've worked with farmers for the past 40 years. We set the bank up to help farmers become more productive, more efficient, help them grow, expand with proper financial backing.
When you say bank, normal banking services or lending predominantly?
The proposition falls into two parts, really, lending and saving. So anybody can save with Oxbury. But the lending proposition is only farmers, and that really falls into three parts: long-term lending out to 25 years, asset finance, which is for your tractors, sprayers, harvesters, etc., commercial vehicles, and then short-term lending, which is sort of input funding. We call it revolving loans, but basically annually reviewed facilities. What we don't do is we don't do a current account.
Okay.
Quite deliberately, because our competition, the high street banks, are really quite good at transactional, just doing checks and direct debits and so on. But where we come in, the difference is we've got relationship managers, about 50 of them now, but growing every month, who speak with farmers, have a one-to-one relationship with farmers. When a farmer wants to speak to us, he picks up the phone, speaks to somebody at the end who speaks farmer.
Okay, now you founded this organisation. Do you have a farming background? Why did you go down this route?
Yes, I've worked very unimaginatively, really, for the last 40-odd years in the farming sector. Started off at ICI Fertilisers, and that will test the memory of some of your listeners, but ICI, the old blue bags, back in 1985, and then Bank of Scotland for a substantial period up until 2000. Then I set up an agricultural IT business, working not really with farmers, but with the supply chain either side of the farmer. Grew that from a UK entity to a global entity. Sold that as ProAgrica in 2015, did an earnout, and then left after 2 years, and then set up Oxbury.
Now, you have a particular focus on sustainability and the environment, and you've launched a related new finance facility. Tell us about that.
What we launched at Leaf was a facility called the Oxbury Transition Facility. And it's worthwhile just saying what we mean by transition. It's nothing to do with us trying to tell farmers how to farm. The facility itself, we have, not to say no interest, but we are not dictating, we're not saying what the farmer should spend the facility on. But by way, what we mean by transition is we think it's really important that farmers reduce their carbon emissions. We think it's really important that farmers focus on soil health and their soil organic carbon, which clearly is going to need some change to farming practices, but continuing to do so profitably. So that's what we mean by transition. So continuing to farm profitability, changing farming practices, reducing carbon emissions, and improving soil health and organic carbon. That's what we mean by it. It's not about telling farmers what to do. Absolutely not.
Okay, so it's called the Transition Facility. What's the facility then?
That transition is not going to happen for free. So farmers are going to need to spend stroke invest in transitioning. And the facility that we're providing is designed to both reward and incentivize farmers in that transition. There's no compulsion about this, by the way. If farmers don't want a transition, they don't need to take this facility. We're still lending to people in the normal way. And in fact, you know, in the last 4 years since we launched, we've lent over £1 billion. So we think this is really important. So the facilities are stage one for farmers who have not yet started transitioning. And in that stage, we're incentivizing, rewarding farmers with a very low rate of 1.5% over base, a 0.75%, 0.75% annual fee, up to £500 per hectare of a limit, with a maximum facility of £500,000, £500,000. And that stage one is for farmers who have not yet started transitioning and they want to get on the on that transition trajectory. Stage two, for people who have started transitioning, we're offering facility of, again, up to £500,000, £500 a hectare. So your 1,000 hectare farm could have a facility of up to 500,000. It's a 6-year facility, so not annually reviewed or anything. It's a 6-year facility. You can draw down from that limit when you need some cash. You can repay, then draw down, then repay, then draw down, and so on. We don't specify what you need, can spend it on. You can spend it on anything. And the rate there is 1% over base. You know, going back 40 years, I can't remember doing a deal at 1 over base. It's a very, very sexy rate. So it's a 1 over base, 0.5% annual fee, no capital repayment.
Okay. And then there's a third stage.
The third one is for Leaf members. So Leaf Mark members, I should say. So Leaf Mark, which is a special designation, they're growers who have already, they've signed up to Leaf, you know, linking environment and farming. That particular standard assurance body, it's a very, very effective organization. And we're providing the same facility for them, up to £500,000, 1% over base, but no fee, because those guys have already proven and are already working hard on the transition and moving towards that style of farming.
What do farmers have to do to qualify for this? Do they actually have to prove that they are going on the journey. How does it all work? I don't need you to go through this sort of detailed application process or anything like
that.
But what have they actually got to do to qualify?
If you're doing SFI, you're in. That's one of the criteria. Or if you're in LEAF, you're in. If you're in a manufacturer or processor, if you're in a retail type scheme, you know, for example, Warburton's Regen Wheat Scheme, if you're in Unilever's Oilseed Rape Scheme, if you're in Arla's Sustainable Milk Production, you're in. So if you're working those kind of schemes, you're already adhering to certain criteria. So that qualifies you. And the third part is if you're doing adhering to certain agronomic practices. So, for example, cover crops or direct drilling or precision application of nitrogen or organic nitrogen, for example, if you're in this in the arable sector. So just to once again reinforce, we're not about telling farmers. If farmers don't want to do this, it's absolutely fine. We're not mandating this as compulsory. This is a reward and incentive for those people that are looking to transition.
Okay.
I should also say as well, Steve, that the what we're giving farmers, a part of the other thing that farmers are working with us on is at the inception of the facility, right at the start, we're requesting a carbon footprint. So we know the start point. What is the farm at the start? What's its carbon emissions? Again, we're not being specific about the carbon calculator they need to use. We'll take the carbon calculator emissions that most farmers have already done one. So we'll take that and we'll use that. We're not mandating one that's specially for us. And then the second thing is on an annual basis, we are doing earth observation, so satellite observation, to determine the changes in soil organic carbon over time. So we track back 6 years. So we've got a 6-year history of what's happened in the field. And then going forward, every year, we'll do a change in the soil organic carbon each year. And I appreciate on sandy soil and difficult soil, it's unlikely to change a lot because it's very difficult to increase soil organic carbon in certain soil types. But we're monitoring both emissions, how soil organic carbon is building, and of course, then the organic, the agronomic practices through either SFI schemes or agronomic practices.
Fascinating. Really is. So you're being able to chart progress towards, shall we say.
Yes.
Nick, just...
And we're not, by the way, the facility isn't linked to that change, because sometimes, again, as you all know, Steve, there are things that happen both in the weather or in farming practices that make change difficult or impossible. So the facility isn't linked to change. It's linked to the adoption of practices that typically lead to change.
Excellent. Mm. Okay. Mm. So where do we go to find out more about this? How do we apply? Is it via the website? Where do we go?
Yeah. So oxbury.com, there's a section on the website, which is the transition facility. How you apply is there, or you speak to one of our 50 relationship managers, if you know who they are. Otherwise, go to the website and contact us via the website.
I can see plenty of people being interested in this. Nick, thank you so much for joining us on the Farming Programme this morning and telling us all about Oxbury's transition facility. Nick Evans, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Also at the LEAF conference, I caught up with a friend of the Farming Programme, the University of Lincoln's Professor Simon Pearson, to get an update on the progress they're making on new technology for agriculture. Simon, given that farming has been pretty effective for hundreds of years, why is technology becoming so important now?
Yeah, well, I think that's a good question. I mean, the great thing about farming, though, it's been incredibly innovative. So it's always innovative, it's been innovating. That's one of the things, actually, why you think food prices haven't changed a huge amount over the last 20, 30 years, because innovation is trying to drive productivity. Now, we've really got to step change on again. We've got to drive productivity even further to keep food prices stable, but farmers got to make a profit. So it will be the profitability driver. I think it's really important. That's all about productivity. You can drive productivity in many ways, but innovation's a vital ingredient.
And from a sustainability point of view, we've got to produce more food, more calories from a potentially reducing area.
That's absolutely right. And if you look at some of the land use framework policies, there'll be even a small amount of land. Then you look at solar, even less land. So we do have to drive productivity. The question is how far we can drive it. Nobody really knows. There's some estimates. I think some people are saying we want to drive productivity by 30% by 2050. Is that possible? I don't know. I'm not convinced. So we've got to see, but we've got to keep trying and we've got to keep going.
Now, you and I have talked about robotics before, but you seem to be focusing this morning a little bit more on AI, artificial intelligence, rather than robotics. Has the focus shifted a bit?
All agriculture robotics are actually AI machines. So we're keeping that focus going. The big thing about AI now is ChatGPT, all those large language models, is a game changer. Only been around for 2 years, so we're just figuring out how to use them. But nevertheless, they will replace or help people with cognitive skills, but you still need a piece of hardware. Agriculture is about the physical world. It's about machines and tools, and that's about robotics. So we've still got to keep going on that, and that's around things like dexterous skills, particularly for worker skills, hands, eye coordination, those sorts of things. And actually, they're hard to do, and that's why I think robotics is more difficult. But nevertheless, we're going to see this huge transformation now with all the investment globally going into AI.
We talked about things like fruit picking, which certain robotics seems to lend itself towards. But fruit is variable. It varies in shape and size and distance from other fruit. How does robotics cope with that?
Yeah, well, I'd say, and I'm not a medical roboticist, but in my opinion, fruit picking is almost as hard as medical robotics. It's really difficult because the environment is so diverse. And there's been a lot of work on it over several years, probably 5 years now. They are homing in, but it's a very, very complex challenge.
Now, we're here at a conference organised by a group that's particularly keen on sustainability and being nature-friendly, climate mitigation and this kind of thing. How can robotics AI help in that area?
A lot of AI is used for data interpretation, understanding the environment. We talked a lot with Liz Bowles, a carbon tool farm kit, around automating data flows and exchange of data. AI is brilliant at that. So once you've got the data, you need the intelligence, and AI can draw that out. So farmers hopefully will make more informed decisions, quicker decisions.
A lot of the kit takes an awful long time to go from somebody's idea to testing to actually in production. What have we got that's available, if you like, now or this year?
Yeah, so there's a lot of we're working very actively on things like mushroom harvesting machines. That's progressing very well. Strawberry harvesting machines with dog tooth are doing very well, so we're seeing lots of innovation there. The big one is obviously robotic milking. They're ubiquitous. And then the next big one probably is robotic weeding. So even Lincolnshire, we're seeing lots of innovative machines. Eco robotics are here, weeding without the use of synthetic pesticides and so on. So robotic weeding is the big one.
Soil health, of course, has become more of a focus over recent years, hasn't it? Using less chemicals, more natural ingredients. Can AI help with that?
Absolutely. It should provide the intelligence to make better decisions. So we're seeing a lot of development now using AI to do things like insect pest recognition, aphid recognition. So we're making steps. We're not quite there yet, but these are things which can be done.
Where's it all going then, Simon? How is all this going to help farmers?
I think it's going to be a dramatic change. I honestly do. In the next 10 years, if AI really does get to grips, probably farming won't look much like it is today. Those drivers are global drivers. And if you look what's happening in America with Donald Trump and Mexican workers, there's going to be a huge amount of investment from Silicon Valley, all those places, going into agricultural robotics. So I think that momentum's going to keep going.
So is some of this going to be to mitigate the fact that we are short of workers here and in the States?
Yep, absolutely right. Yeah, absolutely right. And that will drive the innovation. Without workers, cost prices will go up. That will put pressure on supply chains. And that will drive innovation. And it's already doing that.
There is, of course, final question, a cost to all this. And is the cost benefit from a farmer's point of view working in the positive, or are they going to be investing an awful lot of money to get a small return?
All the robotic developers are making the assumption that they can get the, if you take picking, they'll get the picking cost per kilogram of fruit or veg, whatever, lower than the human cost. And once we hit that crossover point where robots are cheaper than humans, it will fly. And that will be money in the farmer's pocket, and hopefully it will also enable the robotic developers to keep going.
But your research has got to be funded by somebody.
Yeah, and we are worried about that. There's a lot of uncertainty around future funding flows. We're waiting for the spending review from DEFRA to see if farm innovation programs secure. That funding's vital.
Let's keep fingers crossed, Simon, because it's such an essential part of the future of farming.
Well, it is. The future of farming, as I said at the start, farming is about innovation. It's a fantastically innovative industry, and we need that innovation to continue.
All right, Simon Pearson, thank you.
Pleasure.
The Farming Programme. Market
Report. Starting with livestock and auctioneer Edward Middleton from Louth Livestock Market. Morning, Edward.
Good morning, Steve. With it being all sheep week, starting off with the prime hogs, an SQQ this week of 345.38 pence per kilo and an all-in average pounds per head of £158.74. The top spot went to H. Smith & Sons of Theddlethorpe, topping the day's trading at £189 for a pen of 67 kilo Charolais Cross hogs. Just pipped to the post this week were C.A. Mottram & Sons of Lincoln, topping the day for their run of lambs at £186 for 59 kilos. On to the cull ewes, again a super average this week and a super trade all round really in the ewes, with an average this week of £153.28. Top spot again, making it the double in the ewes, went to H. Smith & Sons of Theddlethorpe, topping the ewes at a super £260 for some Texel crosses. Danny Skayman of Lincoln topped at £235 and £223 for Continentals. C.E. Baddeley of Horncastle topped at £218 for Charolais Cross. Sean Worrell of Marsh Chapel topped at £218. And A.J. Colson, Sons of Osby, topped at £152 for some mules. Finally, onto the store lambs. An average this week of £130.20. Top spot went to Woodthorpe Hall Farms Limited of Alford at £148 for some Suffolk crosses. Otby House Farming Company of Walesby sold Suffolks to £138 and Texels to £137. A reminder, we're back business as usual again on this coming Monday, and it's the sale of all cattle, prime cattle, cull cattle and store cattle, and obviously all classes of sheep. I'm Edward Middleton, auctioneer at Louth Livestock Market.
Thanks, Edward. And with an update on the grain markets, Open Fields, Alice Killam. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. In truth, it's been a quiet couple of days with very little movement in numbers from earlier on in the week. They look worse in the UK than they probably are, with us losing a tiny bit of ground in the last couple of hours on Thursday. There have been some physical sales made, mostly old crop, which has generated some interest with those who are looking to move percentage sales on. This is a sensible policy, I think. Are there some bull stories in the market? Yes, I believe there are. But we are 2 weeks away from March and there is a lot to move. Timing is the obvious issue that we have. The US had some slightly higher numbers later on in the week, which was a result of their weekly export numbers. These are still strong and are a long way in front of the progress a year ago. The stocks to use ratio numbers are interesting to look at also. Take China's stock out, which is never leaving China, and you have a number of less than 10%. What this means is they are running on a just-in-time programme. This isn't new, we've been here for some time, but a problem somewhere will create a spike quite quickly. This is what the bulls amongst us are searching for. Other global news, Brazilian agency CONAB have, despite some weather issues, increased their second corn crop forecast in the last couple of days. Projected exports of 34 million tonnes of corn are expected, which gets them a little closer in line with the USDA. I'm not sure what to say about the news in the last couple of days regarding President Trump's phone call with President Putin. I've read two articles, both American analysts, who are now talking the market down because they think that we will lose the war premium that we have in the market if an agreement is made. I did wonder if they're looking at the same page as me. Aside from the fact that Ukraine will agree to give land up to begin with, I'm not sure what war premium these analysts are referring to. We lost this around 18 months ago. What we can say about Russia and Ukraine is that export numbers are slowing. This is something that we've been talking about for some time. Today, the AHDB ran an interesting article about this too, quite thought-provoking. The main bull story that most of us are watching is for their new crop. Still our best chance of a change in fortunes, in my view. Note, thank goodness, it's starting to get warmer in the UK in a week's time, but keep an eye on the map further east. It's getting colder on the 7 to 14 day model. And so we plod along. Yes, there are some bull stories in the market, but the old crop market, with just over 5 months of the trading season left, just won't budge. I think the sensible plan remains the one that we've been following for a little while now. Keep taking cover on old crop unless you're prepared to play the June-July game in an effort to catch the spike if it happens. New crop London actually looks a little expensive if you compare it to the French milling wheat futures, so there is an argument for the forward people to look out for this, and the healthier feed barley base prices too, but I understand why many will keep their powder dry for a month. All eyes on Russian weather. Some guide prices for the week circa Friday morning. Feed wheat, February 180 to 190, April 185 to 195, and May 187 to 197. Feed barley, February 150 to 160, April 155 to 165, and May 157 to 167. All seed rape, February 420 to 430, April 425 to 435, and May 430 to 440. Feed beans, April 215 to 220, and May 220 to 225. As usual, please do call for firm values.
Thanks, Alice.
The Farming Programme. 5-day forecast.
A fairly calm, settled and dry week, with winds only really picking up in the second half when they start gusting to 30 miles per hour, mainly from the south. No rain to speak of, but it will remain cold with daytime highs of 5 or 6 Celsius and overnights down to 1 or 2. It does start to warm up, though, by the end of the week. Next week, Yield Enhancement Network Gold winner Mark Popplewell on how he did it and more from the Lincolnshire Farming Conference. Also next Sunday, don't forget the Lincolnshire Showground Tractor Run in aid of lives and the Agricultural Society takes place, starting at the showground at 10 a.m. as we prepare to kick off the 140th Lincolnshire Show in June. And Tractors into Schools Week starts tomorrow. I'm Steve Orchard. Until the next Farming Programme podcast goes live from 7 o'clock next Sunday morning, have a great week.